now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you from the very beginning. I'm very excited to be with you here today, a new time, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, at noon on the West Coast, Pacific Standard Time. And for those of you who may be new to the program, I would like to say that, first of all, I'm a firm believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything we need for this life in terms of our giftedness, or in terms of our skills and our talents, our strengths, our character traits, our personality, and so forth. And yet, as we go through this life, and perhaps due to some very unpleasant experiences, we may tend to hide our giftedness. We may tend to hide those very good things that are about us, the very best of us. Or perhaps we push that giftedness way down so that others may see it. Or we may even convince ourselves that we're ashamed of it because it just wasn't appreciated before. Or perhaps somewhere along the way we were told that we were never going to amount to anything. Or what other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. At any rate, we do not realize our giftedness, and we go through life functioning from a place of woundedness because we listen to those voices that just do not give that life to us. But instead, we should be coming into every relationship that we have from a place of healing, a place of wholeness, and a place of hachayatas, or uniqueness, as it were. And however, there is so much more to us than what we have become so far, and this is exactly what reclaiming authenticity is all about: having the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Well, overall, these particular broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and mental health within the context of our relationships. And we are in relationships with ourselves and others and God or the divine. And indeed, it is my great pleasure to be with you here today. And I hope that wherever you are, that you're safe and that you are at peace. And how is your heart today? I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, please, I enjoy reading your comments, please visit www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Okay, that's reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be a part of today's show, please call in. I always enjoy talking to listeners. That number to call in and be on the show is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'm happy to report that these broadcasts are now podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again or in case you miss any or part of the show. And I'll be taking your calls in a little while because I really want to hear from you today. And the question I pose to you is, have you ever been contacted by a loved one after they passed? Have you ever been contacted by a loved one after they had passed? Had you ever seen them in a dream that you swear was so real? Have you seen them in a vision? Have you heard their voice? Have you smelled their perfume or cologne and you could swear that they were right beside you, or felt the touch of their presence on your shoulder? And even through technology, or perhaps one of their favorite animals showed up at random. Well, as I mentioned last week at the beginning, here we are at the month of August already, that I will be dedicating the month of August to these themes of after-death communication for last week and this week. And then the last two Fridays in the month of August, I'll be dedicating them to near-death experiences. So that's next week, August 21st and the 28th. So as I said, if you have ever been contacted by a loved one after they passed, please call in. I would love to hear your story and you could share your experience. And today, as I said, we're going to take a look at part two of after-death communication, or as I like to call it, the psychological, emotional, and spiritual benefits of after-death communication. Well, last week, I began the broadcast by sharing with you how I became involved with after-death communication. You see, early in my career as a mental health practitioner and a pastoral professional, I became involved with bereavement counseling. It's something that is just always connected with me, and helping people through their losses and grief issues seemed to really come naturally to me since I grew up experiencing many losses of my own in my own life. And in fact, death and dying was nothing new to me. And the more I sat with people, it seemed as though they really struggled to make sense of their losses. They really struggled to work through these grief issues, which, you know, for the most part, had people completely immobilized. They just didn't know what to do. Whether or not they saw the death of a loved one coming, or their loved one's passing was sudden and dramatic, they were not ready for it, and they were simply not ready for the changes that it would impose upon them as a result of having that relationship, having that person in their life, or so they thought. Because when I also listened to people tell their stories, they would also share these little tidbits with me. These little details about how their loved ones would just show up at random. You know, they would say things like, well, my grandmother showed up the other night in my dreams and told me that I was going to be okay. Or there were times when other people would say, I was out walking last week and I swear I walked right through my mother's perfume. And there was nobody else around me, but it felt as though she was right there. And even some say that, well, sure, I've heard my loved one call out to me. Every now and then, you know, just hear my name being called out, and I knew it was their voice. And as I listened to these stories, I always watched clients' body language, a person's body language. I watched their face. I listened to the words that they shared and the assurance that they had. They had this sense of peace. A peace that came over them like they never had before. In fact, they often would tell their stories in a very peaceful manner, not in some matter-of-fact tone, but in a way in which they knew that their loved one was all right. They knew that their loved one was safe. They knew that their loved one was healed. They knew that their loved one was whole. And in all honesty, I have to say to everybody that I really don't know how after-death communication works. I just know that it does. I just know that people throughout the world who are separated by language and culture and race and ages and gender and so on and so forth, everything that we think divides us, after-death communication actually is something that we all have in common as part of humanity. For other people in different cultures have reported the same things. They too have had dreams of loved ones. They too have heard their loved ones call out to them. They too could swear that their loved one was standing right beside them at any given moment, or perhaps felt the touch on their shoulder and there was nobody around. But they knew, because they recognized the touch, that it was their father or their mother or some other deceased relative. And this is what I love about people who are sharing their stories about these certain experiences, is that there's always this sense of grace in the moment, this sense of peace, this sense of understanding, this reassurance that people have that I'm not alone in this world, that my loved ones are actually close. Well, like I said, I don't know how it works. I just know that it does. And I always make the joke that, you know, just imagine what that must look like up in heaven, where, you know, a loved one comes up to God and just, you know, says to God, God, if it's okay with you, I just want to pop down there for a little bit. I just want to just pop in and just say hello. I just want to, like, tap them on the shoulder and just say, you know, I'm just checking on you. And I'll be away 5 minutes, 5 minutes tops. And I promise, I'll be right back. I won't be long. Is that okay? Really? Really? Is that okay? Okay, great. I'll be right back. Well, I don't know if that's how it works. Like I said, I just take comfort in the fact that it does occur. And many, many, many people experience this after-death communication. Because when you think about it, when a loved one passes, there is this natural urge in us to stay connected to our loved ones. In earlier bereavement studies out there, the advice was that for us to hurry up and get over our losses as quickly as possible and get rid of or donate our loved ones' possessions and move on with our lives and start to connect with other people. Well, the problem with that advice was that it really didn't help people grieve. It only taught us to stuff those feelings and memories of our relationships deep down inside of us as we perhaps put away pictures or other mementos and things like that. And it also, you know, made matters worse when we started to stuff those memories and our feelings when it came to working out our grief, because it totally ignored the fact that we will always be connected to our loved ones. In fact, I'm convinced of it. One of my favorite analogies is that I share with people that if we prick our fingers and we look at our blood, there our loved ones are. In fact, all of our ancestors are right there in that single drop of blood. We can never, you know, get away from them, so to speak, because the same DNA that was in them, the same blood that was in them is the same DNA in blood in us. And so we already have that connection. So even though a loved one may have passed, we're still bonded to them. We still have that connection. And the experiences of receiving an after-death communication, I believe, just affirms that. Affirms that in a very beautiful, tangible way that just reminds us, you know, just how strong that connection is. Well, we will also always be connected with our ancestors and our loved ones, especially when we are reminded, let's say, of their birthdays or, let's say, weddings or funerals and holidays or vacations or any other day that comes to mind. And these times are, you know, normal and healthy for us. Even if the memories we have are not so great, even if the memories are very, very painful. And when this happens, it reminds us that grief is a process, and grief will take time. I think one of the first things that need to be cleared up for many people who don't quite understand what an after-death communication is, or they fear it, or they think it's just something like kind of out of like the Saturday evening creep shows, is just to explain what it is not. And therefore, after-death communication is not us trying to make contact with our loved ones or going to the place of their death, calling out, you know, hello, are you there? Are you there? I would like to talk to you. After-death communication is not that at all. And after-death communication is not about breaking out a Ouija board and contacting our loved ones to get a message about our next big purchase or asking for help making a decision about whether or not it's the right time for us to get married. After-death communication is not that either. And after-death communication is not about attending a seance, you know, to try to make contact with the other side to see if heaven is for real. That was something that, as a child, I was a huge, huge fan of Houdini. I loved how he could work a crowd, and he was just a master illusionist. But he also lived during a time when spiritualism was in full swing. And people had this curiosity about the supernatural, and could we even make contact with our loved ones who have passed on before us? And Houdini went around because he wanted to seek answers, because he wanted to contact his mother and then his wife. But then he would come across one seance after another, and he would expose them for being fraudulent or, you know, doing some kind of trickery. And so, you know, he just went around and he just started to dispel. And he said, look, you know, I really want to know if we're able to talk to our loved ones without some sort of sleight of hand. And who better than Houdini would know this? But be that as it may, what after-death communication is that our loved ones reach out to us. You know, they are universal, in a sense that they occur for anyone, regardless of the differences in culture or language, as I said earlier, and they're spontaneous, and that they are random, and they can occur anytime, whether we are awake or asleep. And most of the time, an after-death communication occurs when we are simply just minding our own business, just going about our merry way. And what I also discovered is that after-death communication are multiple, in that many, many people receive more than one after-death communication. Sometimes people receive a dream of a loved one, and then they have a vision. Or they have a dream, and then they hear their loved one's voice. Or they have a combination of some other form of a loved one reaching out to them. Very, very common. Well, this is something that I also discovered in my own research and listening to people talk about their experiences. In fact, I did present a paper about the universal, multiple, and spontaneous characteristics of after-death communication at the International Near-Death Experience Conference in Virginia Beach back in 2004. And I spoke about how people experienced loved ones who would show up in dreams. And we all have dreams of our loved ones, but these were real. It almost felt like you could reach out and touch your loved one. And also visions. Visions that would last only a few seconds, and then they were gone. But people were swear that even in a split second, they knew who they saw. And people would hear them, you know, their names being called out, and they would respond accordingly. Some would sense their loved one's presence through even a non-indigenous animal who would show up at random, where an animal typically didn't live or an animal was a favorite of your loved one. And some would hear their loved one's voice through a phone, or when the phone would ring, maybe once or twice they'd pick up and nobody was there, but they had this feeling that it was their loved one calling. And some would even, as I said, sense the loved one's presence through smelling their cologne or perfume. But all in all, people receive more than one after-death communication experience, as often as two, three, or more throughout their lives. And as I said, the more I listen to people, you know, starting out and helping people resolve their losses and grief and bereavement. And as they shared these stories of about how a loved one showed up, I started to become even more curious. And I became interested in how this affected the person in terms of working through their loss and grief. I mean, did these encounters help people make sense of their loss? Was there a larger purpose behind them? Did after-death communication help people of faith? Did it help people without faith? Is after-death communication the evidence needed to prove that there's a heaven or that life continues? And was this a way for the loved one to have closure that they needed? And did the person who experienced an after-death communication need that little extra assurance that their loved one was okay and or healed or forgiven? And if this was the case, why then doesn't everybody experience an after-death communication, since everybody experiences the loss of a loved one. Well, herein lies the psychological, emotional, and spiritual benefit of after-death communication. Because after all, regardless of when a loved one dies, really, nobody's fully ready for that. Nobody's ready to say goodbye. We always want more time. And even if a loved one is struggling with a slow and progressive illness, and we see their impending death, we're always asking, one more day. Can I have one more week? Can I have one more month? Can I have one more season? Can I have one more year? Can I just have one more moment where I can hear her voice? Or can I have one more moment when I can see his face? There are also times when the death of a loved one comes without warning, and we simply don't have time to say goodbye. And people really just layers the kind of loss that they experience. They feel like they don't have any closure with their loved one. And in a sense, a loved one reaching out to us through an after-death communication experience, that can be the means which we finally find our peace. It could also be the means by which we find that forgiveness that we need or that we needed to say to them. Or we find that assurance that everything's going to be okay and we don't feel alone anymore. And the same process could be said for finding healing from the emotional wounds of loss and grief. And yet, a common misunderstanding is that once we've assimilated our losses and we've worked through them, that we're going to go back and we're just going to be the same old selves that we were before the loss. You know, our original emotional and psychological and spiritual state. However, this return to the way things used to be kind of mentality doesn't happen. Instead, we're constantly shaped. We are constantly changed by our losses. You can think about it this way. Once we've experienced a loss, our outlook on life has been forever altered by the grief that we sustain. And the reason for this is because our assumptions about life and the world in which we live have now been challenged, if not shattered. We've been accustomed to the routines which define our daily existence. And furthermore, we're never going to see ourselves and others or the world the same as we once did. Because now, experiencing the death of that loved one, we're pulled into the task of trying to make sense out of the new circumstances in light of the old. And many people say, now what am I going to do? I never had a chance to say goodbye. I never told that person how much I love them. I never told that person how sorry I was for saying this or doing that. And yet, after-death communication, when a loved one shows up in a dream or a vision or some other form, it does provide that wonderful closure and that reassurance for us to say, I feel forgiven. I feel at peace. I know that they are whole. I know that they're no longer in any pain. I know that they're no longer suffering because I had this beautiful vision of them standing before me only for a split second. But they looked so healthy. They looked so bright. They were smiling. And for a lot of people, that's what they need to see. That's what they need to hear. That's what they need to experience. And again, I think this is why not everybody receives an after-death communication from a loved one. It's perhaps reserved for people who need help working through their losses. Because instead of assimilating our losses into everyday life, many people resist this kind of healing by continuing to live in a prison of bitterness, reinforced by those familiar patterns of abuse or low self-esteem or feelings of unworthiness. Maybe it was contempt. Maybe it's jealousy. Maybe it's strife. Maybe it's just family dysfunction. But instead of looking for the potential of being made better by our losses, we allow bitterness to harden our hearts, and we keep all others out, all the while that we're cementing all the anguish and pain inside. And the challenge then is for us to discover the courage to redefine ourselves in light of our pain and grief. And yet, we are compelled to ask this question. Is this assimilation process, this grief process, something that I'm able to do on my own? Or do we need help from others? Because all in all, just with understanding after-death communication experiences, I can honestly say that these experiences can be had at any time because it doesn't depend upon us, but rather it depends on perhaps what we need at just the right time. Well, as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, the number is 800-627-6008. Again, 800-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. And again, you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And again, just quickly, just a word about next week's show. It's on Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. And I'll be continuing, as I said, the entire month of August with the subject of near-death experiences. And I would love to hear your stories, starting next week and the following week, the 21st and the 28th. And I encourage you that if you've had a near-death experience and you would like to share your story, please call in. I would love to hear it. Well, many, many years ago, I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Ken Doka, who had done extensive research in the area of hospice and palliative care, pain management. And the things that I read about him were just truly fascinating. I loved his work. I loved his heart. And I wanted to meet him because in my studies and working on my dissertation and so forth was just on loss and grief and how people who experience different types of losses, do they grieve the same or something different? And the populations I was looking at were, I was actually comparing survivors whose loved ones had died from an AIDS-related death, or a loved one who died by suicide, or a loved one who died by cancer. And I was using the grief experience questionnaire. It was a pretty standard questionnaire. However, it was normed on people who had committed suicide. And whether or not, you know, do people who they experience different types of loss in their life, do they grieve the same? Or is their grief, shall we say, more intense? Or is it more difficult for them to work through? And so forth. And what I found as I had studied these populations was that stigma makes all the difference in the world. Stigma is like adding layers upon layers upon layers to our grief. And the interesting thing about all this, and the frustrating thing I should say, is that stigma comes from society. I often joke when I was kicking around this subject, I'm trying to figure out what I wanted to do, is like, society is creating its own problems here because, they're in a sense refusing to allow people to be open about their loss or their grief. And yet at the same time, they're creating this stigma which doesn't allow them to grieve openly. But then they wonder why people turn to drugs or alcohol or some other form, and they just couldn't figure out why productivity went down and why people just can't snap out of it and get back to work. And it was just a vicious, vicious cycle that society was perpetuating. But as I met with Ken Doka, and he had a special fondness for, again, the research that I was doing, and we met. We sat in his little office at the College of New Rochelle in the Bronx, and where you talked about the importance of rebuilding our faith and philosophical assumptions that have been challenged by our losses and have been challenged by our grief. And what impressed me the most about our conversation was how he explained that most of us live our lives according to our assumptions, and how grief causes us to reexamine our core beliefs about how life ought to operate. And after-death communication really causes us to rethink a lot about the finality of death. Are our loved ones truly gone from us? Where are they? When are they? Will we see our loved ones again? And so forth. And whenever we experience the pain of losing a loved one to their death, or our unchallenged assumptions about life or fairness in the world, even the goodness of God, often starts to muddy the waters of the way we process our grief. I mean, unconsciously, we may wonder why we're not allowed to live happily ever after, with our spouses, or a question, what did I do, God? Are you punishing me? And yet the truth is that death and dying is very much a part of life and living. It's just, I think, a cruel joke that's played on all of us when we're babies and toddlers and little kids to, be read the bedtime stories in which everything can be tied up neatly in a bow. And there's always a princess, there's always a prince, and, good things come to those who wait kind of in the end. And we think that that's how my life is going to be. It's going to be ideal. It's going to be perfect. It's going to be easy to manage. There might be a little hardship out, in there, here and there, but don't worry, you're going to live happily ever after. And yet, it doesn't take long for us to come face to face with death and dying. In fact, the earliest, I should say, a national study that looked at, what's the earliest, or at what age do most kids, most people, at what age are they exposed to their first death of a loved one? And the national average is still around somewhere 8 years old, 9 years old, could be 7 years old, depending on the circumstances. But that's average. And so when you think about it, children just do not have that lived experience, that context yet, to make sense out of these losses. And yet, children are often the recipients of after-death communication. And when a child dies, many people often experience an after-death communication from children themselves. And as I said, when people experience after-death communication, it really gives them just a nice kind of nudge in a good direction, a healthy direction, for them to become better instead of bitter about their losses. To be reminded that, you know, death doesn't have the last word. That the last time that we saw our loved ones was not actually going to be the last time that we're going to see or perhaps hear our loved ones. And although we may have been accustomed to, you know, our routines, which define our daily existence, again, every loss is going to shape us. And so we're never going to see ourselves the same way. And if we think about it, once we are able to comprehend that death is real and that someday we too are going to die, despite how difficult that might be for us, our worldview changes. It changes from this naive innocence of life and pleasure and being cared for to a realization that we have to confront our own sickness, our own mortality, our own aging, our own death. But still, we live with the assurances of our faith. We live with perhaps earlier on in our life, we've had an after-death communication experience, and we were reminded the beauty and joy and the peace and the love and the forgiveness that we felt, even if it was just for a split second. We knew, and we know that we know that we know. One of my favorite books is about an ancient story that's told of a spiritual journey of an Indian man called Siddhartha. And he lived during the time of the Buddha. And I highly recommend it if you've never read it. It's a good summer read. And within Buddhism, there is a belief that there is nothing fixed and permanent in this world, because everything and everyone is subject to change. Or, as the Buddha taught, it's in a continuous becoming. I like that, a continuous becoming. And this is what's referred to as impermanence. And if you've ever sat beside a river and watched its flow, or a creek, you get the same idea. You know, the water runs from point to point around rocks and fallen branches and finding the way of least resistance. And at the same time, as we're watching the river, it's not just one continuous united flow. The river of this time we're sitting there is not going to be the same as the river of the next moment. It's always changing. In fact, this is where the expression comes from, that you cannot step into the same river twice, for other waters are ever flowing onto you. A beautiful saying from the ancient philosopher Heraclitus. You cannot step into the same river twice, for the waters are ever flowing onto you. And even though people have these after-death communication experiences, it's as if they've been given a fresh vision, a fresh understanding, a newness to their faith, a newness in their perspective, which they cherish forever and ever. And that same philosophy of not being able to step in the same aspect of the river twice can also be applied to our lives. None of us remain the same throughout our years, and we may think that we're not really changing, but we are. You know, the various stages of our lives, from childhood to adulthood to old age, are not going to be the same at any given time. The child is not the same when he or she grows up and becomes a young adult, nor when he or she grows elderly. And while it is true that we live from moment to moment, we often tend to forget that each moment leads to the next. Impermanence and change are the undeniable truths of our existence. But I also find that after-death communication fits quite nicely into this concept of impermanence. These memories will always stay with us, even though we are changing, and our perspectives will change over time. And perhaps this is one of the reasons why people receive more than one after-death communication. Perhaps, you know, your death of a loved one and your after-death communication occurred within weeks or days of each other, you know, immediately. And then it was another, you know, 3 to 5, 7, maybe 10 years later, you received another one. little reassurances that we need, even though we are changing from moment to moment, little reminders, little aspects of our faith that tell us that our loved one is perhaps waiting for us. Our loved ones reminding us to hang in there. It's worth it. Keep going. The struggle is worth it. Don't give up. But you know, perhaps in my life and in the lives of others, another aspect of after-death communication that helps people the most is with disenfranchised grief. Disenfranchised grief, it's something that I call the double bind. It is something that, let's just stick with just a basic definition so far. It's while most people are, you know, free to mourn the loss of a loved one and to free to experience and express normal grief reactions, others whose loved ones carry this social stigma are not given the right and role and capacity to grieve as others may. And this is something that Ken Doka and I discussed at length because it was something that was also near and dear to his heart. That why does society do this? Why does society dictate who has a right to grieve and who does not? And added to all this, the mourners, the survivors who are caught in this double bind of disenfranchised grief, they also are given very little to no social support or religious support to help facilitate their grief. And Ken Doka argued that the reason for this reaction by society as arising from one or more of the following factors, and here they are. He says, first of all, society might impose this stigma or a person might find themselves in a disenfranchised grief aspect because the relationship to the deceased loved one is not recognized by society, whether it be, you know, different religions or different backgrounds or cultures or whatever, even people who have been divorced. It's just you have no right to grieve as if we can shut it off. But sometimes certain losses are just too uncomfortable for people in society. But yet the pain is real for those who grieve the loss of a loved one. The second thing he says is perhaps the loss itself is not recognized, or it's often viewed as society or by society as insignificant, such as, let's say, the loss of a pet or a perinatal death or stillborn. Now, I have to admit, in this area, society has gotten better at this point. I've seen lots of, you know, sympathy cards, Hallmark cards, American greeting cards, whatever you want to call it, that are specifically designed for addressing the loss of a pet or a loss of a newborn or a stillborn or a miscarriage. So there have been made, you know, some inroads here, some improvements, but still, we have a long way to go because I keep running into people who feel quite disenfranchised because they wanted to talk about their pet's death or they wanted to talk about the child they lost in utero, and it just people didn't want to hear it. People just said, well, you never had a chance to know the child. You never had a chance to know the baby, and therefore, well, okay, it's really no big deal. And that can be very cutting, very hurting for the one who's grieving that loss. Or we just think pets are disposable, that, well, you can always go get another dog, or you can go get another cat, or yeah, just go down to the fish store and get another fish. And it's a total disregard of the attachment and the bond that we have of our animals. And another factor in all this, you know, from Ken Doka about disenfranchised grief is that sometimes the surviving loved one is perceived by society as not having the capacity to mourn. In other words, what he's saying there is that, well, maybe just a child can't understand it, or an elderly person wouldn't be able to acknowledge it, especially if they perhaps had dementia. And those beliefs are being challenged on a daily basis, you know, from others, and just, you know, holding up the hand and just saying, wait a minute, society, children completely understand what's going on. So any business of us trying to shield children from, let's say, an illness or a disease, or attending a funeral or a memorial service, they are quite aware what they're going through, to quote David Bowie. And certainly elderly who live in nursing homes, they are aware when a loved one is deceased, especially a partner or a spouse, and they grieve in their own way. But society says, no, we don't think that they have the capacity to do this. And again, their grief is dismissed. But after-death communication has this reassurance that, yes, deceased loved ones matter. And I love it when the children receive, you know, after-death communication from a deceased grandmother or a grandfather. They have no problem talking about it. And that's what always makes my ears and my heart perk up, that whenever a child says, yeah, grandma shows up, you know, almost every night. You know, and I have to get inquisitive because I want to hear the story. And so it's like, really? What did grandma do? What was she wearing? What was she like? And the child's just very forthcoming, you know, no fear, no stigma, you know, no like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be sharing this. But the child just freely says, yeah, grandma just, well, she was dressed in a nightgown, I think, but she had a big smile on her face and she waved, or she said, you know, that I was going to be okay. And then she was gone. And she usually pops in, you know, every now and then, but usually after I go to bed. You know, and again, it's that childlike innocence of just being able to put these experiences into a loving context of, I'll always be connected with my grandmother. And I shared with you last week a story about a 14-year-old girl that I was counseling. This is years ago. And we were talking about other things in her life and how she could work through her depression. And I don't know how we got on the subject, but she just started talking about her grandmother and how her grandmother would always come and see her every night at 7 o'clock. And, you know, I just said, oh, because grandma lives around the corner. And she's like, no. I said, okay, do you go see grandma? No. Well, oh, okay, I get it. Grandma's living with you. No. And she goes on to tell me that she goes down into their finished basement, kind of like a den down there, and she has her grandmother's clock sitting on top of the mantle. And every night at 7 o'clock, it always chimes. And I'm like, oh, great, that's nice. Does it chime any other time? No. Okay, well, have you put fresh batteries in it? No. Do you just need to plug it in? No. And this girl just goes on to tell me that, look, the clock's been broken. It doesn't run. It doesn't function. But every night at 7 o'clock, and she would, you know, held up her watch, you know, her wristwatch to me and said, look, every night, as she's pointing to her watch, every night at 7 o'clock, my grandmother shows up. The clock starts to chime, and I know it's her. And so, of course, that led to wonderful conversation all about how close that she was with her grandma and just how much she loved her grandma and how she takes comfort in the fact that grandma keeps popping in, and then how this girl would just continue to talk to her grandmother throughout the day and just, you know, grandma, I miss you. You know, I love you very much. I wish you were here, but I know I'll see you, so to speak. I'll hear you, so to speak, at 7 o'clock tonight. And sure enough, I mean, this girl, you know, she's 14 years old. She goes down into the basement 7 o'clock to hear the clock chime a few times. And she gets a big smile on her face as she tells me, and just a wonderful reminder that grandma's just saying hello, and I say hello back to her. Well, these are the kind of experiences, and these are a kind of the stories that people love to share. And I said, with children who receive after-death communication experiences, they tell these stories without any shame, without any pretense, without any stigma attached to it. But they are so open because of that childlike innocence to receive. And even as adults who have lost children, love it when, say, a child shows up through an after-death communication experience, a dream or a vision or something of that nature, and just remind them that they're okay, they're healed, they're safe, they're happy, they're not sick anymore, they're not in pain anymore, they're not suffering anymore. And that just gives people just a wonderful boost to their faith and their understanding that they will see their child again. And this was a story that I'd read briefly last week, about a grandfather who I had a very nice conversation with. His granddaughter Megan had died from an AIDS-related death when she was about 9 years old. And she had contracted AIDS in the womb and just never had a chance from the get-go. She was just constantly sick from day one, and her body was just fighting this disease. And she died when she was about 9 years old. And I was pastoring, you know, the church at the time and went to go see her and everything and counseled the family and just walked with them through this just gut-wrenching, you know, sad, sad story. And I also did Megan's funeral. And, of course, you know, whenever a child dies, it was held in a funeral home, but it could have easily been held anywhere and the place would have been packed. Because it's something about whenever a child dies, everybody grieves. And everybody grieves the loss of not only the child in the present, but also the child of the future. You know, what she would look like when she'd grow up. Who would she look like? What kind of a career would she have chosen? Would she want to remain single, or would she want to be married? Would she want to have one or two kids, or what? It's just that kind of future, and the future of the community was just lost, and it was hard on everybody. Well, a few weeks after her funeral, I get the call from her grandfather, and he says, "Dr. Hauck, you have to see me today. You have to come right now." And I said, well, wait a minute. I have a couple other people to see, but I'll be right there as soon as I can." He goes, "Okay, I'm in hospital so-and-so, and I'm not going anywhere, but I'll wait for you." And I hung up the phone, and I'm just thinking immediately, oh, great. He got, you know, news about a terminal illness and, you know, something about his health. Although, you know, he was just in for, like, routine stuff, and they found some things that they just wanted to keep him for, you know, observation purposes. And I eventually get to the hospital, and I, you know, pulling up the chair alongside him, and he's sitting up in the bed, actually. He's not laying flat or anything, so it was easy to talk to, and we can make eye contact just easily. And he says to me, "Now, Dr. Hauck, I do not want you to tell me that I am crazy." "Okay, well, you know, I don't know what this is all about, but I promise I won't call you crazy." And he went on to say that the night before, he had this vision where he was about 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, he just, you know, was just startled out of just a deep sleep and sat straight up in the bed. And at the foot of the bed, here was Megan, you know, dressed in a nice, you know, little beautiful nightgown, her pajamas. And, she, you know, she looked healthy and whole. And she turned to him and gave him a big smile, a little wave, and then poof, she was gone. And he goes, "I don't know what to make of this. Am I going crazy?" And I said, "Well, you know, you told me not to tell you that. So anyway, what I told him was, I think what you were given by Megan was a beautiful gift. Because the last memory that you had of her was in her casket when she looked very sickly. And she was in a lot of pain. She was suffering before she died." And so he liked that idea, and I could see that brought him a lot of peace and just a real strong connection that he had with his granddaughter. So this is what I mean, that after-death communication also provides people with this emotional, psychological, spiritual, and let's push the envelope here. It could also provide them a lot of just physical healing, a lot of physical peace as well. You know, we certainly feel better. We have this reassurance and this peace that we've been searching for. But it all comes through the fact that we are going to be connected with our loved ones forever. Not just through DNA, but also these wonderful after-death communications that remind us that death doesn't have the final answer. Life does. I'm Dr. James Houck, and it's certainly been my pleasure to be with you here this Friday afternoon, and I look forward to spending this time with you each and every Friday, 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. Please be careful, be safe, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.